I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it.
Good day, people of Earth, and welcome to I Like to Movie Movie. My name is Dan Scully.
I'm Steven Richards.
And we are back. We're kicking off a series today, our countdown to Dead Reckoning. Over the next few months, we're going to dip in every few episodes to knock another Mission Impossible off of our list. So we might see some repeats because we've covered some stuff in the past, but we're going to dig deeper. We're going to dive harder. And your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to put up with our shit until Dead Reckoning Part 2 comes out, which I believe is going to be called Mission Impossible 8, because they've gotten rid of the whole Dead Reckoning thing. But who knows? So many things could happen. Tom Cruise could die before then. We don't know, but you can keep up with us at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. And before we get started, just a little sad news. Just wanted to shout out a friend of the show, Michael Yates. You've known him from most of our Marvel episodes. He was in our YouTube episodes a couple times. He has passed beyond this mortal coil, and so we wish our best to his family and friends, and we just shout out his memory because he was a cool dude. He was the brains behind, Atomic City Comics on, South Street. Just a all around awesome guy. And so he will be missed. And, so dedicating this episode to his memory.
Oh, God.
Now that that's out of the way, let's pep it up a little bit. We have a very special guest on the show today. Steven, I'm going to let you take this away.
It's Megan. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Hi,
it's Megan.
Why don't you introduce yourself to the crowd, to the community?
The community? I am part of the community. You've probably heard me shouted out by Steven on multiple occasions. And yes, he steals all of my great ideas to tell to the audience.
That's true.
I'm here live, and he can't steal any of my thoughts, feelings, or concerns about Mission Impossible. Not today.
Cutting
a lot of times, I will text Megan before I record Movie Movie and say, hey, what are your thoughts about this film? And then regurgitate them as if they're my own on the air.
That's what we like here on Movie Movies. We like people to be genuine. We like people to be real. And we like our hosts to have thoughts not at all their own and just borrowed from listeners, because that's what we want to do. We want to make the listeners feel heard. And we do that by just parroting what they say and acting as if it's our own stuff.
It's a great system.
Okay. It's the same as being his friend in real life. So
yeah,
don't I know it.
So I did enjoy when you did the Oppenheimer episode, because you texted me and were like, what's your synopsis of the movie? Like, how did you feel about it? And that was, instead of doing an ad that episode, you read, Dan read, like, my thoughts on Oppenheimer as, like, the ad. That was a fun shout-out.
Oh, right on.
I did appreciate that. You guys do some fun stuff. I think it's
cool.
Hey,
thanks.
Glad you enjoyed. You can always, always reach out to us if you want a shout-out to be read in ad form at any point. Because,
or I can just hop on now whenever I feel like it.
By all means. By all means.
True.
Always hop on. Or we can just never have you on again and just understand that what Steven's saying is essentially just a proxy for you.
Just me. Yeah.
So
we can even change the title. I like the movie with Dan and Megan, but I'll just record for you on your behalf.
There you go. I like to Megan and Megan with Megan and Megan.
So this idea of bringing Megan along with our ride to our Road to Reckoning, what is it called?
We'll figure it out.
Like Road
basically
to
the title is gonna get, it's gonna pop out of my brain on Sunday right before I post the episode.
Okay,
I'll run it by you. But
well, the title of the chat that we have here in Skype is called Megan Impossible, and that's the idea that I got when I first watched Mission Impossible Fallout with Megan. And I'm gonna summarize what happened, which is basically, we watched the first half, but we had imbibed a little bit that day, so we were like, let's call it halfway through. I forgot how long Fallout is.
It's a long one. It's
a really long movie.
So we called it halfway through, and then like 3 days later, she was like, I got to see what happens. Can I come over and finish the movie? I'm like, yeah. So we finished the movie, and basically, I don't know what exactly was said, but it was something along the lines of, where do I get more of those? And then I was like, guess what? There's 8 more of those, where that came from. And so then I was like, we got to start at the beginning. And at the beginning we did. We watched it a little bit before Christmas, I believe.
Yeah.
And then you revisited it this past Sunday at the same exact time that Dan was watching it. And I was getting texts from both of you updating me on where you were in the movie. And it was, I got to tell you, it was you guys were like neck and neck with almost exactly, like Dan would say something and then Megan would say something very similar about that scene or whatever. Right.
So was there a text from Megan that went hand in hand with me texting you fucking Kittredge?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then I forget who texted me first, but you were probably about 20 minutes away from each other in finishing the film.
Nice.
Which is absolutely wild to me because you've never met before this moment.
I mean, that's the magic of Mission Impossible. You know, it's not about the plan.
It's
about
impossible.
The Mission Impossible team, how they could just improvise everything and make it work out. And that's sort of what we were doing.
Yeah. Now, I did not revisit the movie.
How many times have you seen it? Is there
because
a count?
Between our visit over Christmas and count them, 16 times I've watched it as a child, I think I'm pretty well versed in the film. And I watched a recap that I think was written by AI, but I refreshed myself on a lot of my key points that I like
nice.
To bring up.
AI am I?
So I guess
AI is
start...
actually the villain in Dead Reckoning. So
AI
that's a really fucked up thing to do.
The villain in the new movie, yeah. But let's not spoil too much because Megan hasn't seen any of the other installments except for Fallout.
Oh, this makes the series that much more exciting because you're going to go on a journey because there's different directors each round, at least up until the fifth or sixth one.
The fifth one.
The fifth one where it kind of becomes Christopher McQuarrie's baby. And as such, this series does not really know what it wants to be at any given point. And it kind of becomes a different thing each time around and a better thing each time around. It's one of the few series that like tends to keep improving. Once we get past part two, but we'll figure it out. We'll figure all that out as it moves along. But it's I'm so excited that you haven't seen them because very few people have seen anything less than all of them.
I'm not big on Tom Cruise. Like he was not really like neither of my parents really like watched either of his movies. So he wasn't like a big name for me growing up. They have in theaters. I think the one Mission Impossible movie I did see was Ghost Protocol. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, that's probably my favorite one.
Ghost Protocol is my favorite one, hands down.
It was long ago, so I don't remember much of it. And I don't know anything about 2 besides that it's Steven's absolute favorite. He loves it. He can't talk enough about it.
And
it's John Woo.
I have really struggled with, like, do I want to revisit it again?
Dude,
you have to watch
before
it with me.
Our
not
next episode. I know. And that's basically the conclusion I came to is like, I'll just, you know, I'll make sure to watch it with Megan.
That's the thing about this project, though, is that by going through each of them again, we're going to discover new things. You're going to find things that you do like about it, don't like about it. You're coming at it from a different angle. I mean, the last time I know both of us watched it, we recorded a commentary track, and I don't remember any of it.
And that's another reason why I was like, I should probably rewatch it because the last time I watched it, I was absolutely shit-faced and asked, I forget what I asked regarding Tandaway Newton's character multiple times. That was answered multiple times by you and I just didn't respond.
I think most of that episode was just us just like screaming about how attractive she was in that movie.
Yeah.
So we didn't really get too in-depth of the plot despite watching the whole movie with microphones attached, but that's why you got to watch it again.
Yeah, I will.
You're going to find out that you love it. So, okay, so I guess we should just dive into Mission Impossible 1. This came out in 1996. It is I was looking through the history of the TV show, and it's actually a sequel to the TV show. So it's not a reboot. It's not a remake. They're not doing like a Charlie's Angels kind of thing where they're updating it. It actually follows John Voight plays Mr. Phelps, who was the lead character in both the 1960s Mission Impossible and the 1980s Mission Impossible, which was an ensemble spy movie or spy series that had, you know, a different impossible mission every week that, of course, the Impossible Mission Task Force figures out a way to accomplish. There were a couple made for TV movies. And then this movie came out that kind of brought it into the new generation, recast, Mr. Phelps was originally played by, oh, I'll look it up, but I forget his name off the top of my head. But he was kind of the hero. And so this movie kind of takes it into a different angle. This is
Peter Graves.
Peter Graves, that's it. And this was directed by Brian De Palma, which I think is one of the more interesting things that we could be looking at here. Because nowadays, when you look at a Mission Impossible movie, they are defined by the stunt work. They're defined by Tom Cruise. And this was before all of that. This was before there was a standard stunt piece that needed to be done. This was before there was, like, the actual team as it is now put together. This was Brian De Palma doing a 1960s television show as a movie. It's kind of weird to look back on this original entry to see how different it is from all of the, you know, different from what it has become. But at the same time, I think it's a beautiful and sturdy foundation upon which to rest the series as it grows. And so I ask the two of you, revisiting this movie, what did you think of it? Did it hold up?
Megan?
I enjoyed it. Like, for my, I don't know if we want to do, like, ratings yet or save that to the end.
Right into it, yeah.
But I gave it, like, a 3.5 out of 5 because it felt like it didn't quite make the mark of, like, a 4 to me, but 3 was way too mediocre. Like, it's just kind of middle of the road for me. I think it's a really good starting point for the rest of the series. And, like, obviously there is something – like, that makes you want to go back for more, considering how successful the series has been. I think it's a solid spy movie. And, like, one of the things that I thought about a lot, because one of the questions that we had was kind of, like, how has the genre shifted? And, like, I think we've kind of moved away from the more traditional spy movies, and everything is kind of now just, like, an action movie with spy as, like, a subset of that genre. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is still very much a spy movie because, like, as we said, it's not about, like, you know, the big action and the explosions and the stunts. It's, like, the smaller team. It's a lot more about, like, their dynamics. And I feel like it sets it up really well with, like, the knock list and all that. Like, it feels very underground, very, like, spy, like, saving the world in the like, behind the scenes, where I feel like everything else that we see nowadays, it's all a lot more, like, big picture in your face.
It is true that the threat in this is not, like, a global threat. The only thing that is at risk is the sanctity of the knock list. So the only
which is kind of a global threat
the IMF.
In itself.
I mean, it is, but it's not as much a global threat as, like, if this bad guy gets this special button, he can blow up the world, you know, just like where the future ones go to. This was quite literally just like, well, if they find out the identity of all these secret agents, then we can no longer have secret agents. Whatever shall we do? You know, it really doesn't go any bigger than that. You know, we can extrapolate into what these secret agents then offer with their anonymity. But, yeah, it's really just about clearing Ethan Hunt's name. And keeping the knock list private.
Yeah, this when I revisited this movie, it was just like going home again for me. This was a movie when I was a kid, like I had this on repeat. This, Return of the Jedi, and Mary Poppins were my movies I just watched over and over again as a child.
They're all very similar.
They're all extremely similar, and so I don't think we need to really, you know, talk to my therapist about the connection between those three movies. But I will say that Mission Impossible was also, for me, like the first time I tried to figure out Hollywood shit. And this
How do you mean?
This is a piece of trivia that I learned as a youngin, and probably started my useless archive of knowledge of movies. But it was that Emilio Estevez was not credited for this role because he was friends with Tom Cruise. This happened to be on or near set one day, and he was like, "Hey, do you want to be in this film? We have this role that we need to be filled."
Only if I can get crushed in an elevator.
For one reason or another. And because it was so confusing to me because I was a huge Mighty Ducks fan. And so when I saw Emilio Estevez in this movie, I said to myself, "That's Emilio Estevez. Why isn't his name on the fucking box?" And I might have been like 10. I was probably 10 years old at this point. So I was like, "His name's not on the box. What the fuck is going on?" And this is before the internet, so I couldn't just find out the answer. And I forget how I came across it, but when I did, it was like such a wave of relief for me. And that was the start of my useless knowledge of movies, is that I knew that Emilio Estevez was uncredited in that role, but it was him.
You ready to hear some Emilio Estevez trivia that I recently learned that kind of blew my mind?
Charlie Sheen is his brother.
Well, Charlie Sheen is his brother. Martin Sheen's his dad, but... and actually, he's the one using the real family name.
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen is Carlos Estevez. But in The Mighty Ducks, this was only recently pointed out to me, he's an alcoholic. His name is Gordon Bombay. That's two brands of gin.
Yep.
That blew my mind. That,
yeah.
Gordon's and Bombay. He was this close to be naming Coach Banker's Club.
All right.
No, this was sort of like a executive decision / Scream situation where, you know, like Drew Barrymore, Steven Seagal show up and you're like, "Oh, cool. They're in this movie." "Oh, they're no longer in this movie."
Yeah.
"I thought they might be the star." And then within 5 minutes, they're just out.
I do think that even though like this is a smaller scale movie, like we mentioned, and there's no real stunt work to be had, there is a lot of really interesting ways that they set up characters and motifs for later installments.
And one of them did so without really knowing that there would be later installments.
Well, I think
so. It's almost like the other way, like they knew what to draw upon in making the later installments.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But it's funny to see what the later installments went back and like kind of globbed onto, like, "Let's do this. Let's make sure this happens," or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one of those things that I think happens a lot is the very intense close-up on Tom Cruise's face when he starts to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, like, so much so that his whole face seems to be pulsing because he's thinking so, so hard about what happened and putting all the pieces together. And that, I think, is my favorite motif that is probably in every version of the movie. But you can tell it starts here in two scenes. One, when he's with Kittredge at the restaurant, and two, when he's talking
to... The aquarium?
Which I believe was the name of the restaurant. It was like Aquarium with a K.
Yeah.
Because they were in Prague or whatever. Which
and
I
it
guess
was 96, so yeah. If you spelled something with a K, it was really cool.
It was super extreme.
And then when he's talking to Phelps and figuring out, which we'll get to in a second, that's like one of my favorite scenes. You don't really see in Mission Impossible that much anymore. But when he's talking to Phelps and figuring out what exactly happened the night in Prague.
While also not letting Phelps know that he's figuring it out. That was like, when I first saw this as a kid, I didn't know. This movie confused the shit out of me when I first saw it. And I remember my dad took me to the movies and I had the choice to either see Mission Impossible or the Leslie Nielsen comedy Spy Hard, I believe was the, it was either Spy Hard or Wrongfully Accused. It was one of those two Leslie Nielsen parody movies. And I chose Mission Impossible, much to the dismay of my father, who hates Tom Cruise. And this was one of those situations where we exited that movie and I fucking loved it. And he hated it, namely because, to quote him, "You don't change Mr. Phelps like that." He was very mad about how they had done that. Now, I think really it was just because he does not like Tom Cruise and had made the decision not to like the movie. And I remember being a dumb little kid pretending not to like the movie that I loved for fear of drawing the ire of my father, who has terrible taste in movies outside of his love for Goodfellas. So it was definitely a confusing time, but I've definitely loved this movie since day one, regardless.
I do take back my oh god, because I realize now that I did not knowing that until just now that Mr. Phelps was a character in the show, the lead character. That would, so the equivalent of what your dad experienced would be if all of these chapters that we watched Ethan Hunt fight for the right, fight for the just, and fight for the good, if he were to suddenly turn, we'd probably be just as disillusioned.
Yeah, the thing is, though, like, I don't know, I've never been precious about that kind of stuff as long as the writing's good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can understand why someone would be like, wow, that's shocking, but that's also the point, you know? I'm also the type of person where it's like, oh, I don't like what they did with that character. I can just, you know, just pretend like, okay, I'll just watch the show then instead of the movie. It's, you know, the Halloween series has like 7 different canons that all interweave, and you just pick your favorite, and whichever ones you choose not to have exist, it's all pretend is the beauty of it. So it just doesn't exist if it doesn't, if you choose not to make it exist. It's not an issue to me. But I can understand why some people would be shocked by that. On the other hand, if I was writing this movie, that's such a good idea to be like, yo, let's fuck with this a little bit. Let's take this beloved character and make him not necessarily a bad guy, but a villain. Cause his motivation for doing it was, you know, it's certainly not a good excuse, but the way he explained how, you know, at the end of his career, there's not really much for him to go with. And this was his chance to walk away with a pretty penny and walk away, you know, with something besides just a gold watch for retirement. And I think that that is a valid turn for even the most just character to make, even if it's not something that I would agree with ethically. It's a brilliant writing idea. I would say.
That's a good point. And, like, I think one, like, going off of that, when you're going to change, like, a character, or if you're revamping a series and you want to do something different, I think it is about, like, the integrity of the character and, like, how they're written, where, like, that might be a twist for him, but he's still written the same. Like, they didn't change him. Like, he still has those same characteristics. But
yeah, he was like,
now.
I'm
he's
bad now because being bad gets my dick hard.
I like the way that you said that, just because, like, you do, I did kind of think of him as, like, a villain. But, like, no, he's not doing this to be bad. He's not, like, the bad guy. And I think, like, that, in a sense, kind of goes back to how this is such, like, a small-scale thing about, like, it's just about the Knocklist getting out. Like, this is really just about the agents and, like, the agency. There's no, like, bigger world scale, like, nukes going off or countries being invaded thing that we're trying to, like, stop here. It really just has to do with them. So the fact that, like, the reason that he did all of this is because, like, the agency failed him, like, is
and
very
also,
interesting.
Too, we watch as the agency immediately and without much forethought turns on Ethan. And so we see, like, oh, this is the finicky thing. You know, it's like when you work for a corporation, it's like, yeah, they could just fire you. It doesn't. There's nothing precious here. You could just be canned next week. They don't care. And, you know, I could understand someone being like, well, then fuck it. I'm going to sell the Knocklist. Now, did they have to kill a lot of people to do it? No. That's bad news. But, yeah, I think, and I've only seen a handful of episodes, you know, of Mission Impossible. And I think that it's a sillier show. You know, they do a lot of the mask pool. That was kind of the Mission Impossible TV show's, like, key thing was the mask. And I'm glad that they've kept that around.
You can tell, but they kind of leaned on it as, like, this is the connection to the show that we're
exactly
going to definitely take advantage of.
And the Mr. Phelps in that, in at least as far as I've seen, he was the company man. He was the guy that worked for the company, was good at it, and he was the leader of the team. And I could very much see someone like him becoming disillusioned with time. I've gotten disillusioned with jobs over a lot less, let me tell you. You were there, Steve.
Oh, yeah. I was there at Chili's. R.I.P. Well, I forgot what I was going to say now. I'm thinking about Chili's.
Your appetizers, should you choose to select one, are the triple dipper.
You choose three if you choose the triple dipper.
And if you get the 2 for $20, you actually get to choose 6.
I will say, so this is, like, something for me that I think I didn't actually realize until we watched the first Mission Impossible, when I watched it with you the first time, Steven, is I knew, like, everyone knows the your mission, should you choose to accept it. I didn't know that it was from Mission Impossible.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
So oh, yeah, like, you did say that.
That was like a big thing for me where I was like, oh, wait, that, oh, okay.
Like, I love when so that it happens.
It has a lot of like cultural relevance, I think. Yeah. I will say, I think we missed out on making Asta Lasagna a thing, and that is a travesty to me.
Asta Lasagna, don't get any on ya.
In my notes, I have the phrase written down, Asta Lasagna, don't get any on ya.
Can we talk about the gum real quick?
And I have a note about the gum.
About the gum.
I have a question, and not to spoil anything, because I really want you, Megan, to go into the next chapters of the series as accosted as you can.
You can see, I wish someone chewed the gum. Asta Lasagna, don't get any on you.
I really would love for if, because we think, Dan and I think that the next installment is probably going to be Tom Cruise's last go around on the Mission Impossible series.
Yeah.
I would love if they brought back the gum. Because you don't see the gum in any other chapter. And I think it would be a great callback. And why haven't we seen it again? I feel like that was like a really powerful tool. Yeah.
I wish someone chewed it. To me, it's like, why have it as gum unless you're not going to give it to a bad guy? If they're like, you go, oh, wow, Mr. Phelps, your breath is a little rank. You've been eating some of the whatever they eat in Prague. And you'd be like, yeah, you know, I'd be like, here, have some
pierogies.
Of this. And he'd bite into it and be like, doesn't really have much flavor to it. Boom! Amazing movie. 10 stars out of 5.
Well, that was like when this movie came out, that was parodied on like Mad TV and SNL and even Celebrity Deathmatch, I think, did a little bit on it. So the footage exists.
I would say it's tricky. Like the gum is a cool idea in theory, but the fact that he never just blew himself up because he like snapped it in his pocket or something, like seriously.
It just kept warm in his pocket and melted together.
Yeah. It just turned to goo and
I remember when this movie came out, they did like an article in Disney Adventures all about the cool gadgets that were going to be in the new Mission Impossible movie. And one of them they talked about was the gum.
It was released by Paramount.
And as soon as I saw the gum in this article, I was like, some motherfucker's chewing that gum, and this is going to be the best movie ever. And that's always been my biggest disappointment, is that no point was Ethan like, oh, I got gum. Have some gum.
I think that says something about how the series has, like, progressed, though, because I feel like in our modern, like, action, or in, like, the modern Ethan Hunt, like, compared to what I saw in, like, Fallout, I feel like that is some very much something that they would do in, like, one of the newer movies.
I think in a new one, he'd have to chew the gum himself and survive for some fucking reason.
Somehow. But as, like, a starting point, it's not a very gory movie. Like, the only blood that we get is when Phelps, like, fake kills himself in the beginning. I think that's really, like, it.
I even remember as a kid, when, like, before the reveal of him, you know, having done that to himself, when you see the footage through his glasses of the gun pointed at him, I remember even as a kid being like, did he point that gun at himself?
Yeah.
Because that looks like a pretend gun pointed
the
at
angle
whatever.
Is so
and I just
off.
Went, yeah. And I feel like, but even so, I didn't know what to make of it. I was just like, that was a weird shot choice. But, you know, I was like 12, so it didn't know to think beyond that.
Even on this rewatch, I was like, wow, they did not do a good job with that. That is bad.
But, I mean, I think that might have been a purposeful choice, too. You know, it was probably meant to just be like, oh, what was like? You, did I see that right? And then, you know, they move on from it until we revisit the footage later. But I feel like the Ethan Hunt now would be like, motherfucker pointed the gun at himself. Yep, he's the bad guy.
This is the first time that I remember anyway, that I watched it and recognized the knife from the initial encounter in the alleyway. It's the same knife that he drops into the room where Tom Cruise does what you could call the stunt of the movie where
that
he gets dropped down.
Well, that was in every ad campaign.
Oh yeah.
I remember the PlayStation game. There was the level where you had to do that. And in, I believe, Spy Hard, the Leslie Nielsen movie, that was directly parodied. You know, that was like the bullet time of The Matrix, where every parody, you know, touched upon that.
Yeah.
But also, too, I think the train at the end was like another big stunt, even though it was fake. Nowadays, Mr. Cruise would have absolutely demanded that they do it on a real train with a real helicopter with real exploding gum, and he would have done it.
Thank you for bringing up the train, because I do have a very interesting stat. And okay. I've shared this with you already, Dan. But in every movie in the Mission Impossible franchise that Kittredge is in, there is also a train.
Well, there you go.
Share that one with me as well, yeah.
Think about that. What does it mean?
It means that he's the train guy. I have no clue.
He's
no
the
clue
conductor? Is that what we're going with?
There you go. That's could a better be. Answer than I could come be. Up with. I noticed in the aquarium scene with Kittredge, the shot choices, lots of Dutch angles, lots of, you know, upward, downward angles that were very reminiscent of 60s style filmmaking, especially in spy cinema, because that's all meant to be evocative of catching something at an odd angle, looking askance as opposed to head on. It suggests, sneakiness, if you will. And that was something that I noticed came back in Dead Reckoning. There was a wealth of that type of filmmaking that, and specifically around the scenes involving Kittredge. And it impressed me watching Mission Impossible now. I was like, oh, Macquarie really did his research in Dead Reckoning because he called back to De Palma's style of filmmaking. And if you're a fan of De Palma is very much a, he's almost like a Jonathan Demme, where it's like sort of fly on the wall filmmaking, where you feel like you're in the room watching, but you're not really part of the scene. And, you know, even to the point where sometimes it seems like surveillance footage. And I think that that works. That's probably why they tapped into De Palma to reboot the Mission Impossible series, because he's very good at making this sort of espionage style look, even when he's not working in an espionage style film. And just seeing Macquarie figure that out, ape that, and then build upon it in the new one was very impressive to me. And it never really clicked. I thought it was something he was doing new until I revisited this the other day and I realized he was, you know, almost shot for shot recapturing the way that they do those conversations.
And our rewatch was right after watching Dead Reckoning in the theater when I had a panic attack because I had too much gummy. But even though
he's not even talking about weed, he just ate too many gummy bears.
Too many neon sour worms.
Like, ah, the red five. Ah, it's getting me.
But even it was beneficial for me to have that close quarters comparison, because for the same exact reason you're talking about, is seeing all the great referential stuff and the great amount of research that Macquarie did in both keeping the continuity of the series and also we're kind of respecting your roots. You know, Brian De Palma, even though he didn't do another installment, arguably did one that is probably in the top three for me overall, because of, you know, the origin story in a lot of great franchises is often maybe not the best story, but it's the most solid story because it's what everything is built upon.
But I think, too, like, this was a movie that it was early in Tom Cruise's career as a producer, and he was looking for, you know, celebrities do that where they look for a project like what's her name? Emma Stone. She is now producing movies that put her into interesting lead roles. That's how Poor Things got made, netted her a very well-deserved Oscar. You look at Tom Cruise ultimately ended up doing it with the series and making it his baby and sort of turning it into the Tom Cruise show. And it's funny to watch this as like, oh, he came up with the idea to produce this movie, to make an update on Mission Impossible. And they still hadn't quite figured out whether it was going to be the Tom Cruise show until he was rock climbing in Mission Impossible 2. And, you know,
I was just thinking about how much I fucking hate Mission Impossible 2.
But, you know, what Mission Impossible 2 brings to the series, which we will get to whenever we do the second episode of this, is that it started to kind of figure out how to front and center Tom Cruise without losing what Mission Impossible is. You know, and like 2 kind of steps away from what Mission Impossible is and should be, but kind of brings Tom Cruise into the fold as like he's the center point. Because even though he's the star of this movie, I don't think of it as a Tom Cruise movie as we think of it now, you know?
Yeah,
the same way as like
certainly.
Top Gun, we go, oh yeah, that's a movie about planes that has Tom Cruise in it. Top Gun Maverick is a Tom Cruise movie that just happens to be Top Gun 2.
Yeah.
You know, like A Few Good Men is a movie that has Tom Cruise in it. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning is Tom Cruise the movie, as well as some other things, you know?
Yeah.
And so to see this sort of being like the birthplace of, you know, Tom Cruise trying to find what that series is going to be, that, because even like in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, they were going to start to bring Jeremy Renner into it.
And then he became then, Hawkeye.
Yeah, well, and then Tom Cruise was going to move into something that was a little bit less physically taxing with the Jack Reacher series. And then ultimately they just tied his ass to a plane, shipped Jeremy Renner off to another series, and Tom Cruise came back, Jack Reacher became a show. But like, you can tell they were always trying to figure out a way to facilitate, like, how do we keep the Tom machine pump running? How do we keep the Tom machine running? And this is like the ignition in the keys of the Tom machine.
Do you know that? I think we've talked about this before, but there, he has specific ways of training to get that run the way that it is.
I'm not surprised.
And also, that's not how he normally runs. He said this. He's like, I don't normally run like that. I only do that for film.
I wonder how he normally runs.
I don't know. I would love to see it.
Yeah. He's like late for a flight.
I think he said something about like how it's supposed to look like all the motions are exaggerated because that's what he's doing.
I mean, he has an iconic, great run.
Yeah. People,
and it's a very cinematic run because across this series, when he's running, you know, anybody can run. But when Tom Cruise runs, you're like, oh, shit, he cares about the mission. And I can see it in the way that he runs.
And I was surprised that, and I think I mentioned this when we were watching it together, but I was surprised that he had it cultivated this early in his career, because he runs from that bridge to that car when it blows up in the same exact way. And it's, I was like, there it is. Great.
That's the birth.
Yeah. The signature run. It is there. I think this one, we only get that one. Like, I feel like in the newer one, we see, I mean, he does it like 5 times.
In the newer ones, they make time for like, yeah. if they need to edit down for time, because the producer's like, hey, can we cut this down to 2 hours and 45 minutes instead of 3 hours? They will cut lines of dialogue before they cut Tom Cruise running.
Oh, they'll cut
they will
whole characters
cut important
out.
Lines of dialogue before they cut Tom Cruise running.
Like, this movie makes no sense, but my God, that boy can run.
God, he looks like a gazelle.
He's a little smaller than a gazelle.
A tiny baby gazelle.
That was always my...
too many teeth.
My dad, who hates Tom Cruise, he always makes the same statement. He was like, they try to make him out to be this tough guy, but he's really just a wimp. I'm like, you know, he's really doing all of these things. He is the tough guy that you think he's not. Like, that's him swinging off of Burj Khalifa with a rope tied to his ass. Like, that's actually happening.
I did ruin, Megan brought up his teeth earlier. I did ruin center tooth.
Oh,
Megan.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
They center up as the series moves forward. He got that fixed.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
It's very prominent in, like, the one or two scenes that he, like, smiles, like, dead on in the first one, and it's just glaring.
Yeah.
He's, like, it's, you know, not to be that guy, but if you ever watch, like, early Tom Cruise stuff, like, if you ever watch The Outsiders, he's fucking ugly. He's straight up just like an ugly, gnarly looking dweeb. And then, you know, towards the late 90s, he becomes the hunk that we know. I mean, now granted, you know, he had like his sex appeal era, but like, if you ever watch The Outsiders, his teeth are fucked up. He just looks all scraggly and stuff. It's not until he becomes a leading man that they really start to lean into any sort of physical attractiveness. And then it's kind of funny too, because he had like his sexy period, and then after Eyes Wide Shut, he became a distinctly asexual being. There's just, he spent it all on Eyes Wide Shut, an Interview with a Vampire, and then now he is just here for the stunts. Even in the new Top Gun, there's like a sex scene, but it's not even really a sex scene. It's just they hang out in bed together, and it's just like a slow motion montage where they're just like smiling near one another, because he just does not read as a sex symbol anymore.
No.
He's a stunt symbol now.
Yeah, he didn't in this movie at all for me. Like, the weird kind of attraction storyline that they try to go with like him and Claire, I just like it falls way flat for me. I'm like, it just didn't make any sense. We didn't need it. I don't know why she was with Phelps either to begin with.
Money. That was a new development because I don't believe he had a wife in the show.
But yeah, I could have done without that like subplot and their weird like non-tension that they had.
I think you're right, though. This is probably right around the time where we started to, like, divorce him from sexual appeal because it's just not there. There's no chemistry. Like, the only reason there's, like, a will-they-won't-they between them is just because that's the shape of the movie. Like, I don't actually feel it between them.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought there was a delay there. We just,
No.
No, that's how unenthused we are with his sexuality. We just, he sucks all the air out of the room even when he's not here.
Although, have we seen Eyes Wide Shut?
No.
Because that is a horny, salacious movie. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And he is brilliant in it. And it is a movie that rests upon, it's like a Blue Balls movie almost. And now granted, it is him and Nicole Kidman were married at the time, so they were able to sort of draw upon actual sexual attraction because they were married to one another. And I think that the movie, you know, really leans into that. But, like, beyond extraneous circumstances like that, yeah, he is just a wet fart in that department. It just, there's just nothing about it. And then, I can't wait until we do Mission Impossible 2 because they really try to sexify it and it is not
it's
there.
It's so bad.
Can't wait.
And the theme is by Limp Bizkit.
Don't spoil anything.
I don't know if I'm the one to associate the word spoil with in terms of adding Limp Bizkit to the soundtrack. Because in this one, they took the Lalo Schifrin original score and Danny Elfman updated it for the Mission Impossible movie and I think did a wonderful job. But that iconic Mission Impossible theme is just, it's unfuckwithable. It's perfect. It says spies. Hello, my little sexies. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. Remember, if you want to follow along on this amazing 8-episode mission, which won't be back-to-back, but we will be doing it for the time leading up to the new movie. We're gonna hit them all, but we're gonna hit a lot of other stuff in between. We've got interviews, we've got specials, lots of stuff coming up. And if you want to be a part of it, which you should because you're very cool people, make sure you follow the show at Movie MovieCast on all of the things. And while you're at it, check out our other show, Hot Property, at Hot Property Pod on all of the things. And if you go onto the Hot Property Pod Twitter, you have a chance right now to vote for our Munch Madness bracket. We are crowning the ultimate munchie, so make sure your voice is heard. As Puff Daddy would say, vote or die. And then don't do anything else that Puff Daddy says to do, because that man is in a lot of trouble. I love you all. Back to the show.
Megan, in this viewing, the scene that we brought up earlier when he's figuring it out in front of Phelps, but not letting Phelps know.
Yes, I got it this time.
Okay.
Like that.
That's a confusing sequence.
Yeah. Well, it was even more confusing because she was falling asleep last time.
Yeah, the first time we watched it, I literally fell asleep in the scene where he is like rappelling down. Like that scene was happening. It's the climax of the movie, and I like passed out.
Well, in your defense, they did have to be very quiet.
It was silent, which I honestly love, like as a way to build like tension, and I think that goes back to like De Palma and like what he did as a director in this, like cutting the music in like a scene like that to just like build that tension and like just how serious it is. Like, I absolutely love, and like that, honestly, between that and when he is piecing everything together, like in his mind in that scene, those are like the two best scenes of the movie for me.
For sure. I think that of all the things that like carry on stylistically throughout the series, I think it is the quiet computer hack scene because it has all of the things that we come to know eventually in the series, which is, you know, multiple members of a team, each with a different set of skills, improving their way through a planned but liquid circumstance where anything can go wrong and they just have to rely on their individual skills to get through. There's high tech. There's gadgets that we have absolutely no clue how they obtained them, but we just know that they work. High stakes. And then also that scene has most of the film's comedy. And these films do get a lot funnier as they move along. Ghost Protocol is hilarious. And it's usually hilarious in the way that the team interacts with one another or makes their mark look like a buffoon. In this case, I forget his name, but the guy who is who's working at Langley, who has access to the computer, they squirt some puke juice into his coffee. And so it's this super tense scene that is cut back and forth with his stomach upset, we'll call it. And I think really is quite funny and played for laughs that do work, even to the point of Jean Reno seeing a mouse and he almost drops Ethan, you know, and that's just meant to be funny that this tough guy who fears nothing is afraid of a little mouse. And all of that, like that whole scene is expanded into feature length in future entries. I think that's where this movie really finds what it, or at least where the sequels find like what people want to see, because people came out of Mission Impossible. That was the scene everyone was talking about.
The only thing that there's two things about the scene you're talking about where they make the guy throw up that kind of throw me. One is if I'm at work at a cafeteria table, and someone sits that close to me,
dude,
I'm gonna, yeah. I don't care how attractive you are, I'm saying, like, excuse me.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Like, there's so many seats here. Yeah. You're right there.
The other thing.
For someone who's on a secret mission trying to, like, blend in, why did she wear a red suit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That drove me crazy. I'm like, everyone is in black, and you're just showing up in red, and no one thinks that's strange, and you're trying to blend in.
I think she was doing the opposite, though. I think it was less that she was trying to blend in. I think she was trying to call attention to herself.
Yeah.
Because I think that she was supposed to be a visual distraction to let them get by as firemen. Because everyone's like, wait, you can't go in there, sir. Whoa, hubba hubba. You know, like,
but
I think that was
one of the firemen. Didn't she sneak in with them?
She snuck in with them, and then as they had to go in deeper, before Tom Cruise kicks that guy in the mouth, There was definitely a moment where, like, her attractiveness was used as sort of a red herring to draw eyes away. But,
I thought she snuck in with them also dressed as a fireman.
Then when she broke off from it, she's meant to draw the eyes within the building. Although that does backfire again, though, like you were saying, Stephen, when you sit down directly next to your mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think she was able to get away with nobody being like, excuse me, ma'am, you don't work here, because they were too busy to be like, excuse me, man, hello. You know, like there was that sort of response to her visually, I think, allowed her to get a little bit deeper in. But no, she was definitely one of the firemen. How they got a fire truck, I don't know.
Well, I like that. Well, because Max had fronted them a bunch of money.
We're entering Fast and Furious territory with that explanation.
I'm just saying, you know, it was explained in the rules of the movie. But my point is, my favorite part about the fireman shtick is that Luther, who had was not to be seen by the public, still dressed up as a firefighter in the back with his computer and all his like tech set up. He still was wearing the suspenders for absolutely no goddamn reason.
Because he just looks like a badass in suspenders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, I think even, like, that plays with his character, too. He's like, no, I'm dressing up.
Yeah. He's like, we got – do you have an extra pair? Well, then I'm wearing them. I like some suspenders.
I also like how this is, like, Luther is one of the OGs back from, like, day one.
Mm. Yeah, I do appreciate that. And he is probably – one of my favorite characters in the movie. Like
he's just without a doubt my favorite character in the movie.
So as like far as like really minor characters go, I actually enjoy Max.
Mm.
Like I know she's not part of like the team and she's not even really part of the main story. Like
we never see her again.
And you never see her again. But I just think she plays that part like very well of like she's just like calm, cool, collected, like constantly in control. And she's like, okay, you can catch me, but I'll still get out of it. She plays that so well to me, and, like, I just like a sassy, understated
connected
woman.
Connected and smarter than everyone.
Yeah.
I would love
that's Vanessa Redgrave. She's a legend. That would be really cool. Because, yeah, this ends with her just potentially getting locked up. Yeah. But, like, I'm sure she has a way around it. Like, I'm confident. Like you were saying, Megan, I'm confident she knows her way out of it.
Yeah, her last line is literally, like, call my lawyers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she's just, like, not even fazed.
Yeah. And her email address was, like, what was it? It was, like, job@job31space4.job.
job@job.
Yes. Yeah.
This was, I had a note in, well, in my notes that was just, the way that we all understood the internet and computers to work in 1996 before they were ubiquitous is so funny. And when you go back and look at like tech forward movies at that time, before we were all tech savvy just by nature of being alive in our culture, movies could get away with murder in terms of what computers can and can't do because we didn't know enough to call bullshit on it. It's like that meme going around where it's from some music video where Brandy is texting a guy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When they show the screen of her phone, it's just like a small Excel spreadsheet. It's like, but like yeah. Back then, we didn't fucking know. You know, we were just like, oh, she's rich. She's got text messages. Now it's. You know, it's nothing.
It was actually Destiny's Child.
Destiny's Child, yeah.
Yeah.
And back when there was like five of Destiny's children as opposed to the three and then eventual one left.
My note, it just says, the internet is new, which, you know, it was so funny to watch the old, because even in that era when we had established OS like Windows, watching the recreation of that, like nowadays the equivalent would be like, a phone OS that they didn't get the rights to use. They had to make one up just for the visual aspect of it for texting in today's modern television. Watching somebody create an OS that's really outdated and not even real was really hilarious to me.
Even in a Jurassic Park, there's a scene where they watch like a live video feed and you can just see the time code and the track bar at the bottom playing it because it's just a file. It's not at all a live video feed.
I'm surprised in the very beginning that they didn't, the guy that was being set up to reveal the name of who has the original knock list, I'm surprised he didn't realize there was something going on because it was lit like a Spanish soap opera.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised that the mark had no idea he was in trouble.
I just thought it was kind of odd that Tom Cruise was dressed as Dr. Fauci in the opening scene. He looked just like him.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
He's starting on mission. We're going to make sure everyone is vaccinated.
Right.
I also noticed...
The technology has come far. It's rough in the first movie.
Well, it's funny. In the TV show, the way that they would do it is it would be... So say that, Ethan Hunt is under me. I would just go like this, and then they'd cut to someone else like, oh? And then they'd cut back to him with the mask already stretched. Because no one can just pull the mask off. They have to stretch it and then pull it off so that we get the full effect. Here they were able to like digitally fleece it a little bit. And then by the new ones, they actually show like how they build the masks and stuff. It's really great how they do that. In terms of dated technology, I made a note here that at one point, Luther refers to encryption, and he uses the short form version of encryption. He refers to it as crypto, which has a completely different meaning now. He's like, even with the best crypto, we're not going to be able to get, hide this kind of thing. And I was like, are they talking about digital currencies?
Bitcoin?
Nope, just talking about encryption. And I thought that was fascinating, like how times have changed. Crypto has a completely different meaning.
Yeah. It was even the mask quality looked, it made me question, like, all right, I've seen where the tech comes from in later installments, where you get these fucking Spirit of Halloween, like thick rubber masks made so quickly.
They're really bad. Yeah. There's also the senator that like Ethan Hunt impersonates. They didn't hire an actor for him. Like when they show the video clip of him, it's just Tom Cruise in the mask.
Yeah.
Like, and you can clearly tell when they like show him when they're at the party later.
You called that pretty quickly to the point where like we had just started the movie and Megan was like, is that Tom Cruise? And I'm like, God damn it. She's going to hate this fucking movie.
So basically what this means is that you could be a super spy yourself, Megan, because you're a step ahead of the curve. Yeah, that's something that in the future movies that they do is they always replace it with the actual actor and then just do the reveal, you know, digitally. And I believe in future entries, they do the fun thing where they'll put the mask on someone and then with digital trickery and, you know, hidden angles and stuff, then replace them with the actor, which is a really fun switcheroo. I also have a note here. Ethan Hunt has parents.
Yeah.
That's a weird thing. His family is eliminated from the series here on out. His dad is dead. They do mention that. But his mom and his uncle that were used as leverage against him in this one, they were arrested for some drug crime that they weren't for as a way of, I don't remember, fucking Kittredge. And that's just a weird thing. Like his familial bonds are completely gone for the rest of the series. They sort of get him into a romance. It is the family.
Replace it with like the wife. But yeah, that is kind of odd. And I guess you could say like that does kind of give you an idea of like they didn't know what was going to come of this. Like they didn't put a lot of effort into that. They didn't build it into anything because they didn't know if they were going to have another movie after like the first one.
I think it was definitely a few years between the first one and the second one. Like, it's definitely they didn't intend a sequel, or at least didn't expect one. So it was just a thread that was sort of cast
four
off.
4 years.
4 years, yeah. So 2000, yeah, wow. That is
it
a 2000
sense that
movie.
Mission Impossible 2 came out in 2000 because it is the most 2000s movie ever created.
Just the, like, thumbnail that's on, like, Amazon Prime for it just looks like so 2000.
Oh, it's ridiculous. It's John Woo. He's doing John Woo shit.
The original title.
You don't like it, isn't it?
What?
Steven, because it's John Woo?
No, it's a great John Woo movie.
Yeah,
it's a fucking terrible Mission Impossible movie.
Someone pointed
out. Absorb it into the Fast franchise?
It would fit so well in the Fast franchise, it's not even funny.
Well, I think that a friend of mine pointed this out, and it doesn't track one to one, but he said that the way he said it was guns don't belong in a Mission Impossible movie. Now, granted, there are guns used in a Mission Impossible movie very frequently, but
just really awkwardly and usually pointed at yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, like the guns are used sparingly, whereas Mission Impossible 2 is a run-and-gun movie, which is a John Woo staple. You know, run-gun, motorcycles, trench coats, that's what we're doing. And, like, that doesn't read Mission Impossible, that reads Hard Boiled, that reads Face Off, you know, that reads John Woo. Yeah, it has a different intention. What else did I have in the notes? I don't know, what do you guys have?
We can just run down do you want to introduce our list of criterion that we're judging movies on?
Oh, I wanted to point out something made me laugh so hard in this movie. And it's just a simple little like blink if you miss it choice, but I've ran it back so many times. So on the train at the end, when they're climbing across the top, the wind's in everybody's face, the helicopter comes down and Mr. Phelps is about to clip himself to the helicopter, and instead Ethan Hunt clips it to the train. And when he does, he clips it to the train, and then he looks directly at the pilot and goes, "Ah!" and just screams as loud as he can. And it's the weirdest choice.
Yeah.
In the moment, though, I get it. If I was on top of a train like that, I would never stop screaming. I would just been screaming the entire time. But the fact that he did it, and instead of being like, "Boom, gotcha," he just, "Ah!"
I feel like that's a very Tom Cruise choice.
Yes,
like, I don't feel like any other actor would do that. And I feel like that plays a lot into Ethan Hunt as a character. He's very much like the renegade. He's like man on a mission, loose cannon. And like, I feel like Tom Cruise really like plays into that.
Oh, yeah.
And I just find it so funny because he is kind of dorky.
That's his superpower, though, and I think that's what makes, you know, that's sort of what informs Ethan Hunt in the future. I'm glad you said this, because his superpower is improv, where it's the plan's going to shit, but I'll figure it out. My back's against the wall, I'll figure it out. And it's like, oh, I don't know what to do, but fuck it, I'll flip the helicopter to this, let's see what happens. You know, it's something.
One of the scenes that also kind of highlights that's more subdued is when I'm, like, blanking on his name right now, but when he tries to steal the knock list. afterwards. And he kind of starts doing like the magic trick thing with like the disc around and all of that. That kind of like plays, it's like on a much smaller scale, but that plays into his kind of like thinking on his feet and like this weird persona that he has. Because, like, he almost becomes, like, a different person in that moment to me. Like, all of a sudden, he's literally, like, a sage magician.
Yeah.
And he's, like, not really, like, Ethan Hunt anymore. And he's just, like, this very, like, unhinged, like, character of himself.
Unhinged,
like,
Tom
it's just kind of, like, dialed into 100. And I feel like that's the first time you really get to, like, see it. And, like, in the middle of the action scenes, you don't, like, see it in that same way. But just in this, like, hotel room, watching him do all that was just, like... Like, that, to me, really, like, solidifies, like, that character and, like, Tom Cruise being that character and what he brings to it.
And especially, too, when we find out that the other guy actually did have the correct knock list. And that was clearly just him being like, I got to come up with something to get that out of his hand that isn't knocking him in the head and getting it out of his hand. And so he does the whole sleight. And actually, the sleight of hand comes back in Dead Reckoning again. They do a lot of sleight of hand in that. And, yeah, it's, I think you're right. It's, I mean, even in the aquarium, in that moment, he doesn't know what to do, but he's got the gum. So he just, let's blow up the fish, see what happens. And it gets him out of there. Like, he's always ready to do the improv. And, you know, even down to, the scene where he's hanging in the computer thing, that had so many instances where the plan didn't go to plan. And it's just, all right, we'll figure it out. Just keep going. And that is his superpower, is his ability to just come up with shit on the fly and hope that it works.
My one, like, point with that scene of just, like, discontent is that there has to be some kind of, like, spy winch, like, that they can use.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Like, the guy has to just, like, hold him there.
Oh, he could have just cranked it, yeah.
Yeah, just how is there not just, like, a spy winch?
Yeah, so they have a little, like, digital box that contains the laser, but they don't have a crank. Yeah.
We don't have a crank. We don't have any kind of other a pulley system, anything, some kind of technology.
Well, there was a pulley system, but I still to this day, after almost 20 viewings of this movie, have no idea how the pulley system worked.
I do have a slight idea how it works, because if you ever go rock climbing, they have the little lock that's a gree-gree, it's called, and that's sort of the crank that you can let things in and out. But if you don't have that, there is a pulley system that you use with your hands, and you don't have to hold all the weight because the pulley system distributes it. And I think that's what they're working on here. But I think that was just a filmmaking choice, because the crank eliminates the mouse gag, which eliminates him having to fall all the way down. And so it's like, what's the trade? But then again, I think you're right. It's like they have a gadget for everything, and they don't have the one gadget that actually exists in the real world.
Yeah.
They have all these pretend gadgets and none of that. I was a little – I have a bugaboo with that scene too. The sweat droplet on the glasses, when they finally fall and you're like, what's he going to do? And then it just cuts to an insert shot of his hand catching the drop. And it doesn't really have any poetry as to where his hand is in relation to that. You just go, oh, good, he caught it.
Because you see him falling, and he's, like, flailing, and he's so close to the floor that I'm like, he would have, like, swiped his hand to get it there that quickly to catch that, and, like, lost his balance completely. So, like, yeah.
In the time that it took him to do that, he could have just been like, just done one of those. But then again, we're building tension, so.
In my notes for that scene... I just had in capital letters at first, I'm stressed. And then the second thing was a second bead, like the second bead of sweat just got me. And then when what's his face drops the knife, I was just like, are you fucking kidding?
That's so fun though. But that's another great humorous moment when the dude comes back in and sees the knife and is like, what the fuck is this? That was a good humorous moment. And I am a sucker for a side character being so shocked by something that they pass out. So I really have a big belly laugh when the train conductor at the end sees the crashed helicopter and it's just like, oh, aces. Love that kind of shit.
I also love the quintessential, like, blade stopping right at his fucking giant Adam's apple.
Well, that's the thing with Ethan Hunt, is he always just makes it.
Yeah.
It's this close every time, but he's gonna do it. He can't not. Just because the mission's impossible, he makes it possible.
He does.
That's what they do. They're the mission. They're the Impossible Mission Task Force. So we asked this question on the show before, and a few weeks back after a concert, I was at a bar and Mission Impossible was on the TV screen, and I was very drunk. And I led a, I was holding court at the bar as I'm wont to do when I'm drunk, and got a lot of people involved in what ended up being a very hearty argument as to Ethan Hunt with all of his resources, John Wick with all of his resources, who wins? And the thing is, John Wick cannot be stopped, but Ethan Hunt will always figure out a way to win. It's a rock and a hard place situation. Where do you place your, where do you place your allegiances?
John Wick, but he rips the mask off, and then it was Ethan Hunt all along.
That's the move.
That's what it is.
In order to defeat your enemy, you must become your enemy.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I think.
I think Ethan Hunt wins because John Wick has no resources.
Yeah, but John Wick can't be stopped. He's who you send to kill the boogeyman. John Wick would just do this with his jacket and become bulletproof.
Yeah, it's the Kevlar jacket bit just kind of like negates everything else.
But the other thing too is that
Ethan Hunt will figure it out. He'll find a way. We'll find out that he switched the jackets, and no one knew. You know, there's always something.
Tom Cruise is also like very reliant on getting information out of people, and John Wick is a man of few words.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. I feel like what would happen is they would just be at each other, and then they'd either just get old and die or just say fuck it and get married, and then the fight's over, and they're just loving husbands, and they go on missions together. And
I'd watch that movie.
Yeah, that would be a real good movie. Actually, that's the origin story of Lestat. He becomes a vampire. They live forever. The two of them together. Yeah, I don't know who would win. In my heart of hearts, I feel like John Wick simply because he's just got so many weapons. But at the same time, Ethan Hunt just never doesn't figure it out. He's stealing helicopters. He's got exploding gum. He can get blown to safety by explosions rather frequently. He got the masks. I just really don't know.
I think I'm going Ethan Hunt. Because if you think that taking down John Wick is impossible, well, then he's already won.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I guess if we are to believe the end of John Wick 4, even though he is ended on his own terms, he does meet his end.
Yeah.
Whereas Ethan Hunt's still going.
I don't
see
an end.
You don't even got arthritis. Yeah.
I don't see an end to this hunt.
Yeah. What was that? I was listening to something the other day, and somebody referred to Ethan Hawke as Ethan Hunt, and I just loved that they messed that up. And I was like, I love that they're both cultural icons, and one of them's real. Love it. Who wins in a fight, Ethan Hunt or Ethan Hawke?
I don't know. Ethan Hawke could probably charm him into peace, into a time of peace, you know?
Yeah, if it's a Shakespeare reading contest, yeah. I think I'm going with Ethan Hawke. But, then again, if it's a really cool mask that makes you look like someone else contest, it's Hunt all day.
Obviously.
All right, let's go through the notes and see what we didn't cover. Oh, wait, I want to throw this out there. I wrote down my favorite line in the whole movie. It's a line from Luther. When at the end he gets put back into rotation as an agent, he's off of the disavowed list, and he says, "I don't know, I'm going to miss being disreputable." And then Ethan says, "Well, if it makes you feel any better, I'll always think of you that way." And then we cue the Cranberries song, "Dreams" by the Cranberries, as the closing credits music.
Yeah,
mwah! That is why I go to the movies, my friends. That is how it's done.
And they stick together for another 8 installments.
But that line really does capture their relationship and just the way that they bounce off of one another. Their rapport is the word I'm looking for. Yeah, he's like the only, I think, outside of Tom Cruise, Luther might be the only supporting character that's in every movie.
Is he in the second one? I don't remember.
He's got to be. I feel like he has to be. But I will find out soon enough. We'll find out in a few weeks' time.
He is. He is in it. He's, yeah.
Let's pull up these notes. Yeah, he's got to be in it because he's the one member of the team, because the formation of the team itself is like an act of improv. Yeah. Because it's not that they assemble a team. It's that throughout each movie, he picks up and drops off members until we finally reach like the core five that we have now. You know, I feel like they're people kind of cycle in and out or get killed or get reassigned or whatever. But him and Luther all day. So, oh, nope, that's the snack madness. So, okay, so one of our notes is what was purged from the series that this movie had in it. And there's only one thing that I noticed, and it's that there are multiple shots that are shown from Ethan's first-person point of view. And that's a De Palma thing through and through. And I don't think that ever shows up again, nor does Ethan having hallucinations that are not accurate. When at the rendezvous point after the mission in Prague goes to shit, he hallucinates Mr. Phelps coming in the room, and then it turns out that it's, and I'm gonna forget her name, it turns out that it's her. And we never see him hallucinate or have any sort of loss of his lucidity like that ever again. Claire, that's it. We never see that ever again.
No, that's not true. He hallucinates in the third one.
I don't remember. What is it? What? No, is he drugged, or is it just...
We'll get there when we get there. We'll get there when we get there.
Fair enough.
What did it purge from the series for me? And this is, you know, we haven't started the series yet, but I'll tell you what it purged for me is any preconceived notion of what a spy movie could be.
Damn straight.
Yeah.
Actually, the day after I revisited this, I revisited True Lies, which is one of my all-time favorite movies, and it's also like a fun spy caper. And as I was like writing down notes for this today, I realized that I was integrating elements from both movies into my thoughts, and I was like, I've kept forgetting which movie was which, because they have a very similar production design and a very similar sense of fun.
I got to revisit that one.
Dude, it is... It is just pure entertainment. It's so much fun. It's my favorite James Cameron movie. It's my favorite Schwarzenegger movie. It's my favorite Tom Arnold movie, if there is such a thing.
My favorite Tom Arnold movie is Small Soldiers. That was Phil Hartman.
I thought you were gonna say The Stupids. Remember that movie?
No.
Oh. Well, it's a good thing you don't remember it, because it's not good.
Megan, any thoughts on what it purged from the series? Even though this is.
Yeah, I didn't have anything for this just because, like, I really have really only seen this one and, like, devoted a lot of, like, thought to this one. The only thing that I jokingly put was the possibility of Ethan Hunt ever having a love interest, just because Tom Cruise. But I do think, like, as far as spy movies go and, like, spy. I don't know why my brain is blanking on words, but, series, like, I feel like this is one of the only really big, like, spy movie series. There's like this and Bond. And I was kind of like, I was trying to think of other ones, and I was like, I guess like Jason Bourne sort of, but, like, I categorize that differently. It just like feels like a different type of movie. And so, like, I think that's something that isn't purged, but necessarily is something that was brought forward, is like, I feel like this is kind of like a one of a kind in that sense. There's not really like a lot of other spy movies that approach like genre and like spy espionage and action the same way that this does. And that's like unique about it. So I couldn't really think of things that they got rid of, but things that they brought to the table. Like, from that standpoint, I feel like this movie has done, like, a lot.
I think you're absolutely right. This is, like, very unique, and you see its imprint on other movies. Like, the way that the Fast and Furious movies sort of become an ensemble spy thing, that didn't happen without Mission Impossible doing it first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they were literally about car racing, and sure, there was characters we liked and disliked, but the whole idea of, like, oh, we're going to put together a team, that is, Mission Impossible They were the progenitors of that, for sure.
Even, not even just with Fast and Furious, but, like, one of the other which you're probably going to hate me for saying, Stephen, but one of the other ones that I was thinking of that does this too, that grows in a similar way, is actually like Die Hard.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
When you get into, oh, yeah, like, that's Live fair. Free or Die Hard, like, you have your tech guy, you have John McClane, like, you have the baddie, Timothy Oliphant, I think, in that one. Yeah. So good. But, like, it's that, like, formula that has, we, like, I feel like action movies are now becoming, like, spy movies in that sense, and it's based on this type of spy movie, like, what, oh, yeah, Mission Impossible is. Like, they have those same kinds of, like, themes in them, and that's why I was, like, I was trying to think of, like, other spy movies, and I kept just thinking of all of these action movies, and I'm like, that's not, like, there's no spies in it, but they follow all of those same kind of, like, tropes.
Even the most recent Jurassic Park movie had action sequences where they took the old characters of Jurassic Park and the new characters of Jurassic World and sort of implanted them into those sorts of roles to do
into a
large
terrible
scale
script.
Action. Oh, it's a garbage movie, but they were very much doing a post Fast and Furious thing, which then you go, it's all back to post Mission Impossible.
You know what they forgot to put in that movie when they were getting all the old cast and the new cast together? Dinosaurs.
Let's say imagination, because yeah, there was none in that movie. Creativity. Literally, the last movie before it promised the next movie is going to be all about if dinosaurs take over the world again. And then the next movie starts, they're like, there's killer bugs!
Yeah.
Huh? Huh?
Locusts are the bad guys.
All locusts right. are already the bad guys. You're
also the dark
new.
Web. Oh, that was that was the second one. So this is my favorite. Can we move on to this question? My favorite yeah. question of the bunch. How Tom is Tom in this movie?
I think this is before Tom got that level of self-awareness that, because yeah. like at the risk of spoiling anything, Rogue Nation literally parodies the idea of Tom Cruise in its opening scene. They have him running into the big stunt as the opening scene, and the joke is, we can't figure out how to do this mission, and then he just runs in like, I'll do it! I'll just go grab the plate and go! Ah! and sure enough. And so I think that this, the seeds of Tom as we know him are planted. Because this is before Tom's downfall, before he's on the couch with Oprah, before he's condemning mental health treatments, before he went through that crazy period.
Before he kidnapped Katie Holmes.
And then sort of earned his way back by doing crazy stunts for us. So he didn't quite have Tom Cruise as the brand yet. But as I was saying earlier, this as one of his early producing projects was definitely a stab in the dark as to can we find the franchise for Tom? Can we find the thing that Tom Cruise is? And so I think that you know, more so than you watch something like Cocktail or A Few Good Men or anything like that, or Days of Thunder, where Tom Cruise is an actor who's in the movie. This is like the first time where we're getting shades of Tom Cruise the brand. But it's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And I gave it 3 out of 5 Toms. like similar to how like the movie as a whole is like a 3.5 out of 5 for me. And I think it's because it is sort of that starting point. And like in that same sense, as you're saying, Dan, like we don't have Tom at his height yet. Because he himself hadn't established, like, what that is. And I think we get moments of it as he's, like, also figuring out who Ethan is as a character and kind of that, like, loose cannon, kind of unhinged, like, quality that, like, comes out sometimes. And, like, we don't get as many stunts. Like, we don't have him flying a helicopter. Like, we only get our one signature run in the beginning. So, like, all of those things that I think, like, you've can kind of, you know, tick off on your fingers when you watch a Mission Impossible movie. We don't necessarily, like, rely on so much in this film, and he doesn't rely on them. So, and I kind of honestly like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I like that it's kind of unestablished, and there isn't this, like, precedence that's been set yet.
I think Tom Cruise is a really good actor when he's tasked with really doing acting.
Same.
Yeah.
And, like, this movie is a reminder that Ethan Hunt is actually a character. And I think it's a character that persists rather strongly throughout the series. And we do sometimes dismiss it as like, oh, it's just Tom Cruise doing Tom Cruise. And this movie sort of reminds that even when you're at the seventh movie, no, it is definitely a character that he's doing. That said, it does feel a lot less like acting when Tom Cruise is doing his brand, as opposed to when you watch something like Magnolia, and it's like, oh, that is capital A acting right there. You know, like he's doing something big and strange there. I hear he's courting the new Tarantino project, which I'm very excited about.
That'd be cool.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
I gave it one Tom out of five because I know I have the foresight to know I need to leave room to grow in this scale. So I'm gonna drop it down to a one Tom out of five.
I'm in the three Toms out of five simply because, like, up until this, in terms of Tom the brand, he's never exceeded two, and, like, we're starting to have a dalliance with that there. This movie, though, I think in a vacuum is damn near perfect.
I think it's great.
Like, as if there was no sequels, I'd be like, this movie's perfect. It's exactly what a reboot, sequel, whatever, to the series needs to be. It's a brilliant idea, executed very well. But when you see what the franchise becomes, it's definitely just, you know, it's a drop in the bucket in terms of what it offers in the realm of what we typically expect from a Mission Impossible movie. If it was the Mission Impossible movie, the only one, though, it's like, flawless.
I think the detriment of the later chapters does take away from this as a potentially perfect film, for sure. But the trade-off that it gives us in absolute spectacle, I'm okay with.
Exactly. We're going to the movies. You want to see?
We're going to the movies, baby.
You want to eat too many gummies and damn near have a heart attack when he's hanging off of a train?
I'm telling you, that scene fucked me up.
It's intense, man. I was stone cold sober that night and was on the edge of my seat.
Like, Megan, you wrote down, I'm panicking or I'm uncomfortable.
I'm stressed.
Now, if I had something to write with, that's what I'd be writing over and over and over again in this experience.
There is a note that we have here that who is our favorite supporting character? Do we even need to ask that? Are we all in agreement?
Luther. Yeah. Luther? It's always Luther.
I'm going to out Megan here. One of the texts Megan sent me during her viewing was, I keep wanting to call Luther Felix. I don't know why.
I have no idea why. That was just the name that popped.
My point being is that he does look like a Felix. Like if they're like, this guy's name is Felix, I would totally believe it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I feel like I want a hacker named Felix.
Yeah.
He has that moment.
I love when Simon Pegg gets introduced to the fold. And I think Megan, you'll enjoy that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's really great. He kind of becomes like buddy buddies with Luther. They have a good rapport back and forth. Luther has that cool moment on the train where he's blocking the transfer of the knock list
with a Nokia cell phone.
The Nokia cell phone. And when he realizes shit's about to go down, he just plants the phone and starts moving. And then a very helpful employee of the train hands him the phone, like, sir, you forgot your phone. And he has this look on his face that's just like, you just blew this, sir. You completely blew this whole thing, but he doesn't let that betray him. He just does like the thank you and moves along. And it's beautiful because A, just cool as a cucumber. And B, that's the first time that the team is faced with a moment where he's like, he's going to handle it. He'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I did my part. He'll figure it out. Keep the train rolling. Love it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, because you guys are like, this is a near perfect movie. And I don't, like, it's a very good movie to me. I think I was very nitpicky about it just because, I know how big the franchise is. And kind of, like, coming into this as more of, like, the outsider, I wanted to try to, like, pull at as many things as that I could and kind of just, like, be more of, like, a critical thinker with it. Because, like, I think if I didn't do that, like, I love action movies. Like, I love spy movies. Like, they're just fun and enjoyable. And so, like, it is still a very fun movie. But, like, when I think about all of the, like, gadgetry and just, like, Ethan Hunt in general as a character, like, to be this person who's supposed to kind of be, like, the spy To like kind of see him fall into all of these like traps and like not notice things that seem really like obvious that could have like helped him along the way for me, for like the character building and stuff. Like, it just like didn't line up necessarily. So like, that's kind of why I'm like, eh. And like, I think some of the entertainment factor will come like later on as we get more into like some of those tropes and like the stunts and all of that comes in.
For sure. I think you're right. I have no angle with which I can view this movie with any sort of objectivity, simply because my love for the series on the whole is, it's just imprinted in the folds of my brain. It would be impossible for me to see flaws. Ah, Mission Impossible. It would be impossible for me to really nitpick. So it's actually good that you do, because I just want to glow about this movie.
It's very difficult to look at. Like, I can watch this movie, and I know if I had seen this as a child, I would, like, absolutely love this, and I would be same way. Like, if I was watching this when I was 10, like, this would have been one of my favorite movies.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Even now, like, the effects on the final train scene, I think they hold up relatively well.
I agree.
Compared to a lot of things. Yeah. And, like, I was watching the 4K disc, so it was, like, very high definition, and a lot of older movies suffer in that format because you can see the seams. But even if I could see the seams, it would be impossible for me to regard it as anything but my memories of it, seeing it in the theater as a child. It's just impossible to do.
Yeah.
And I'm no Ethan Hunt. When something's impossible, I can't do it. I'm not going to lie. When things don't go to plan, what I do is I crumble, and then I let that failure define the next few months of my life. That's how I deal with impossible situations. You cry your way through it, you pawn the responsibility on someone else, and then you take that rage you feel towards yourself and you take it out on other people. That's my method. But Ethan Hunt's a better man than me. But I think I'm a distinctly more sexual being than him. So these are the trades that you make.
No contest. Yeah.
these are the trades that you make.
I agree.
And I can't run that well because my knees are shot. No. So what are you going to do? I have too many thetans in my body. They haven't been purged, and I don't have the money for Scientology, so I'm just going to have to deal with them.
I'm proud of us that we haven't brought up Scientology this whole podcast.
Well, I blew it.
There's plenty of – I'm sure we'll get into it once the timeline lines up with his Scientology antics. Yeah.
The only other questions that we have on the note are more for the later movies in the series, which are like, what did the director bring to the series, and has the genre shifted at all?
And I think we have that latter question earlier.
Yeah, we've sort of covered, you know, what this movie is different from the other ones. But I do think that, like, I love the idea that they reached, I imagine they reached out to De Palma to do this movie. I don't know if this was something that he came up with, you know, I don't know how familiar you guys are with, like, De Palma's work, but he did, like, Blowout, he did Carrie, you know, he's a very, very strong, The Untouchables, very strong director.
L.A. Confidential?
Did he do L.A. Confidential?
I thought so.
I think that's one of the Gilroys. Or is that John Dahl? I don't know. But either way, De Palma doesn't actually stick to
Curtis Hanson.
Oh, Curtis Hanson, yeah.
I fucked up.
He doesn't stick to one genre across his filmography at all, but his stylistic markers are everywhere, and I think he's a really good choice for this. That said, one thing De Palma doesn't do is action. So as this series sort of leans heavier into the more action elements of it, it would make sense that they would then move to a John Woo, to a J.J. Abrams, to a Brad Bird, to Christopher McQuarrie. Like, it makes sense that they would go that direction with it. But I think De Palma's DNA ultimately does persist throughout the whole series, and we'll just have to make a note to track that as we move through to see. And maybe in the interim, watch some De Palma, because if you haven't seen a lot, there's a lot of gold there.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. Blowout takes place in your backyard, Stephen.
In my backyard?
Like, almost literally, yeah. For real.
That's pretty cool.
Blowout rules. But yeah, the inciting incident of Blowout takes place right at the falls, right in front of the barbecue joint as you turn up Ridge.
Oh, the Wiz?
Yeah, Withicken. Nice. Couldn't think of it, yeah. That's cool. The bad guy's John Lithgow. who's a Philly boy.
Oh yeah. And the good guy is John Travolta, who's also a Scientologist.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, he's great. And it's got Nancy Allen from RoboCop. She's wonderful. Oh, Blowout is just exceptional cinema. But if you watch it, you'll definitely see where the stylistic DNA that De Palma defines himself with in Mission Impossible. You'll see it all over it.
Yeah.
I had to look up, like, De Palma. I'm not really one of those people that's, like, super familiar with directors. And so, like, when I looked up some of his movies and kind of the things that he's known for, it seems like things that have a lot of suspense, more like crime movies and even some, like, thrillers. And I, like, felt a lot of that kind of, like, undertone in the movie the entire time where, like, there's a lot of moments that are just kind of, like, unsettling. And, like, you can't really put, like, a finger on why. But he, like, does a really good job of, like, building suspense and making people seem kind of, like, unhinged at certain moments. And, like, knowing when, like, seeing when the actors hold back and when they kind of, like, release more emotion, especially, like, I feel like John Voight, like, Phelps is very kind of, like, even-keeled the entire time until the end. And then he just kind of, like, I feel like at the end is actually when he starts to feel like a villain. Where, like, up to that point, you don't really, like, see him as a bad guy. And, like, some of that comes in with, like, the score, knowing when to, like, be loud, when to have it just be, like, silent and, like, build the tension. So I do think, like, he played around a lot with just, like, how the movie felt when he was, like, putting the scenes together and, like, how the characters felt and being able to, like, just kind of feel all that tension.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I hope to see carried, like, throughout. Mm. I know it's kind of going to get a little more, like, campy as we go on, but that's something that I hope, like, stays.
I think it sticks around. It loses that sort of, like, salacious edge, but it definitely persists. And actually, you saying that about Mr. Phelps kind of clicked a point in my head. The final scene on the train, I think what we're seeing there when he kind of, like, starts to become more villainous is we see that he's just not as good at improvising as Ethan Hunt is. Because yeah. When Ethan Hunt's plan goes to shit, he figures it out. When Mr. Phelps' plan goes to shit, he's kind of at a loss. He does not know what to do. He's clinging to a helicopter in a tunnel, and it's just like, yeah, you blew it, dude. Like, your plan is fucked at this point. But, yeah, I think that... there was an era where when a De Palma movie would come out, the trailers would refer to him as, quote, the master of the erotic thriller. And I don't even know if I agree with that assessment, but that was sort of the vibes that his movies would put forth. And I think that they were trying to tap into a little bit of that sort of vibe here. And so the eroticism of it, as we've determined, is not really there. And that fades very quickly, the even attempts towards that. But I hope that you'll find that sort of thrilling espionage-like edge that he brings does persist throughout the series. Maybe after part two. Part two is really just about getting those bullets out as fast as possible, as much as possible. Boom. Fred Durst, Wes Borland, cranking it. Yeah. It's wild.
It is wild.
Expecting the equivalent of, like, Tokyo Drift as Mission Impossible.
Hey, Tokyo Drift's a good movie.
The way that you talk about it.
It's more if, like, Face Off / Broken Arrow / Hard Target became a Mission Impossible. And those are all John Woo movies, but that's sort of the angle that it takes is just, you know, this is as long as you're doing a somersault, a bullet's not going to hit you. You know, as long as you have two guns and if you push your hands as you shoot, it actually makes the bullets go even faster out of the gun because you're adding the speed of your hand to the speed of the gun, which also makes them more accurate. And it has this weird idea that Tom Cruise looks good in slow motion with a trench coat. He doesn't, but it is what it is, you know. But we'll get to it in a few weeks' time. We'll set that up after we're done here and have some fun with that.
Awesome. I'm excited.
Any closing thoughts about the movie? I think we've hit it all.
I'm good.
Yeah, same.
All right. Well, you can follow the show at MovieMovieCast on all of the things. You can check out my website at scullyvision.com. I'll be digitally covering some of the Overlook Fest this week, so check that out. Next week is the Philadelphia Film Society Spring Fest, and I think I'll be covering that as well. So check out the website for stuff on that. We are going to skip a week of movie just to sort of, I've got stuff to get out from under with all these festivals, but I might drop a couple bonus dispatches from the fest. So we will be back, not in 2 weeks, but I guess in about 4 weeks time to do either the next series of this or another movie in between. We'll figure that out. You can also check out our other show at Hot Property. There's no breaks going on there. At Hot Property Pod on all of the things. Do either of you have anything you would like to
plug? We're in the middle of a Munch Madness over at Hot Property Pod.
Yes.
So please go to our Twitter at Hot Property Pod or our X. What do you call it now?
I still call it Twitter because I don't have respect for Elon Musk. It's fine.
At Hot Property Pod in there and vote on who you want to make the next round of our Munch Madness.
Yes.
If I had a Twitter account, I would just spam it with votes for Cheez-It, but I don't. So you're
lucky.
You
only vote once.
Well, Cheez-Its are on the list. Yeah. So will they beat Cheetos? Time will tell.
Yeah, Cheez-Its barely eked in, not going to lie.
Yeah, but Cheez-Its versus Cheetos is a battle for the ages.
That is a battle for the ages. Well, I'll give you, I wouldn't choose.
Since I'm not voting, Megan, I'll give you my Twitter account for a day, and you can vote on my behalf.
Okay. Then you're voting for Cheez-Its.
Everybody vote. We're going to crown the ultimate munchie, the ultimate stack for Munch Madness. And, and Megan, thank you so much for being on the show. We look forward to having you in again to go through this, this mission. So we'll
another
eight
times.
Time. Eight more
wait.
Of these. I love a good series though.
That
and by the time we're
impossible.
Done, it'll be, but we will make it possible. We've put together a team and we will get the job done.
And then we'll go see Dead Reckoning Part 2 or whatever name it is together.
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to be, but if that comes out, if the press screening comes around, I'll get a +2 on it. We can all go there and party together.
Oh yeah.
And we'll feed Steve a bunch of gummies and watch him flip out.
I was going to say no gummies this time.
Oh, no, I'm going to take more gummies because you got to every installment, you've got to layer on some more. That's what Mission Impossible does.
Bring you a notepad so you can write, I'm panicking.
Yeah. me jamming the pen through the pad.
Yeah, your notepad just reads, ah!
All
right on. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back in a few weeks with more. And that's been I Like to Movie. And as Tom Cruise likes to say,
we'll see you at the movies.